Hi again, welcome back. I wish I had a dollar, well, even 10 cents, for every email I've received dealing with the chemtrail issue. And I'm not like our guest tonight, Clifford Carnicom, who has spent so much of his life poring over data and poking his nose and his intelligence and his wisdom into this most perplexing of problems that has been with us now for a little over 3 years. This chemtrail phenomenon has caused friendships to break apart, probably caused marital strife that we'll never understand the extent of. It has caused arguments. It has caused heartache. But more than that, it has caused apparently illness, poor health, and I'm sure more than a couple of cases of terminal illness in people whose immune systems have been compromised going into this thing, or were dragged down by whatever has been going on. For those of you who have seen them, you'll know what I'm talking about. For those of you who haven't, I would urge you to go to Clifford Carnicom's website. It is C-A-R-N-I-M-O-N, Carnicom.com, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, Carnicom.com, and click on Chemtrail Crimes and Cover-Up Documented, and start reading. But before you start reading, look at the pictures. Prepare to be amazed. And then maybe things, for those of you who haven't really noticed chemtrails before, will start to fall into place. You'll remember that, gosh gee, I did see something like that, and this is what it was? Yes, this is what it was. And back tonight for an update on this most perplexing and at times certainly enraging of apparent government operations being conducted in this country over our heads and into our bodies is Clifford Carnicom himself. Welcome back, Clifford. How are you?
Good evening, Jeff. Very well. And thanks very much for the opportunity to speak with you again. I know it's been a little while.
Sure. Well, a lot has been happening, and you have, again, at your own time and expense, been working this issue as much as any human being could do. We know chemtrails are real. We don't know exactly what's going on. If, in fact, there is one program underway, maybe, there may be several. We just don't know. Clifford Carnicom's data on the website is overwhelmingly compelling. We're going to talk about much of that tonight, and we're going to focus on the electromagnetic, the EMF aspects of what may be involved with this most visible of phenomena. Clifford, what's been going on lately in the last month or two? Have reports stayed the same as we've headed into late fall and approaching winter, or is there a change?
Well, I would say in terms of general character, at least from the sense I have from reports as well as locally, after September 11th events, the skies were refreshingly clear, I would say, for probably 2 weeks to 3 weeks. About a three-week period elapsed, and then almost seemed like all hell broke loose because things got real heavy for the month or two after that.
That's true.
So, you know, whether you're dealing with a makeup situation for lost time, that might be one question, but I would certainly say there has been no decrease in the level of the program other than there was a hiatus due to, you know, national events of that magnitude and particularly involving aircraft.
Sure. I remember the emails pouring in from people in the Portland, Oregon area saying they had never been sprayed harder and more often than they were, as you say, several weeks after September 11th, when the program was reapplied, as it were, to the landmass of the continental United States and, of course, other areas around the world. It's not just here.
Right. You know, and one of the reasons I wanted to speak, and I really appreciate the opportunity, is because I really haven't had time to keep up with all the material posting on the website. And there's been some material which is at least appears to be consolidating or converging towards some centralized themes that I'm simply not able to keep up with on the website. And I thought it would be helpful at least to get the material out there for people to begin investigating themselves and to potentially set some directions for further research and activity and activism by people.
Good. That's one thing that's important is to remember always that Clifford is asking for your help. If you want to become involved in this, the more the merrier, and the better we can approach this subject with more data, more people looking, and Clifford always happy to help. His website, again, is a treasury of data and will open the door for many of you who want to take this a little bit further. Quickly, though, back to September 11th and shortly thereafter, Clifford, I had a number of emails from people who reported there were some spraying activities underway when the skies were supposed to be clear of commercial traffic. Did you get many reports about that?
I certainly encountered the reports. I know there were some satellite imagery that people had referred to. You know, I think it's unfortunate that this is one of the cases where you never have had this centralized network on this, and that's very deliberate, where everything is operating on a grassroots level.
Sure.
In order to bring attention. But, you know, that's an occasion where if there was simply an organized framework in place to document the events that are occurring, that would have been an opportunity. I think as it is, again, we are faced with, you know, fragmentary, grassroots, isolated accounts.
Uh-huh.
But exactly to that effect, that in some areas, that wasn't the case here
right.
in Albuquerque by any means, or Santa Fe, and the skies were conspicuously clear
right.
For several days and really up to a couple of weeks after very light air traffic.
I saw recently, again, another aircraft too high for me to identify, but it's spraying along and then turning it off and turning it on, just like a Skywriter would, and it's amazing when you see it. Make a believer out of many, many people, and it has, in fact, when you watch that going on.
Right, and the help that I'm speaking of, that we're referring to, is really beyond, you know, the point of someone simply sitting there observing it. Truly, there's been a legitimate need for professional involvement and assistance for some time now, and I think that will only be accentuated tonight. This is a very serious issue. And there is a need for professional involvement in very highly technical fields, as well as medical fields and chemistry and this type
Correct.
Of thing.
Correct. You know, to tie this in, and I don't really know how to do it very adroitly at this point in time, but to look at what has happened in the country politically since September 11th in terms of the restriction of our freedoms, the basic nullification of certainly portions of the Bill of Rights, by the anti-terror or Patriot Bill, which was passed. And I again want to remind you, by the House of Representatives, without even having seen that bill in print, friends, shame, shame, shame on the men and women who voted for that without even having read it. But I don't know ultimately if we'll find the linkage or not. I just don't know. But I do know that whoever is doing chemtrail operations and deploying whatever it is they're deploying, are in some way, at some level, connected with the so-called shadow government that is really pulling the strings behind this country.
Yes, and the word complicit, I guess, has to come to mind at some point from my side. I guess if we have the luxury, there were a couple things I wanted to mention before we got into the main direction of the topic, and it's very much related to what you're speaking of, and that is I did want to bring attention to a page that you posted about a week ago, roughly. And when I saw that page, to me, it was immediately apparent that it was important enough to present that at the top of my site, and that is the page that related to the FBI flyer on the U.S. Constitution,
right?
If you recall that. And I think that every citizen in the country needs to be aware of what has happened, in this case from a law enforcement point of view, that has, you know, literally classified individuals who defend the United States Constitution and or make numerous references to the United States Constitution as a terrorist threat. I think that that's a sad state of affairs, and it shows a mindset which we all need to be aware is in place. If you recall, one of the shows that you and I did was devoted almost exclusively, or at least in large measure, to constitutional issues.
Correct.
So by no means will I exclude myself in any way, and I hope that all American citizens will not exclude themselves and consider themselves to be defenders of the United States Constitution, and I hope that we are all intimately familiar with that document, and more so than we are now. And I will continue to make numerous references to the United States Constitution, and I will continue to defend the Constitution. I think it's a gross injustice to the American people that such a flyer by a national law enforcement agency was ever even presented.
It was, in fact, created by the Phoenix FBI office and circulated to all law enforcement in the state of Arizona. It made its way around the country. This happened actually several years ago, subsequent to the Oklahoma City bombing, but as Clifford said, the mindset was in place. And now, when you look at the new definition of what they call domestic terrorist or domestic terrorism, you really start to worry. And if you're not worried, you're misinformed, and you better catch up real quick. Be right back with Clifford Carnicom in just a minute. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you are here, and please do visit my website for real news all the time at Rentz.com. Once again, the website to bookmark and continue to go back to and take your friends, Carnicom.com, and look for the chemtrails investigation that has been so beautifully presented over such a long period of time. Heroic is my term for the work that Clifford has done for all of us in trying to bring the truth forward to what is being done over our very heads. Okay, Clifford, go ahead and let's get into it.
Thanks, Jeff. Do we have a couple hours tonight, do you think?
We have total of 3 hours of airtime.
So
I'm giving you the whole program.
Okay, at least I don't need to rush within an hour or so.
No.
Okay,
we've got until, 10 o'clock Pacific, 1 o'clock Eastern.
Okay, well, thanks. We'll see how that develops. The second item, small item to catch up with, but not any less important in terms of timing. I looked up today and I see that we spoke on the 20th of June, I think was the last time we spoke.
That long ago, wow.
5 to 6 months ago, right. And so there's been some things that have transpired in between, and I'm going to try to sort of catch up and build up into the main topic of electromagnetics. Small item, but important, on this EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, if you recall, there was a rather extended chronology of a sample of materials being sent to that agency, the head of the agency, that material being sent by certified mail, that material not being acknowledged to exist by that agency, no reference to it whatsoever, even though it was physically known to have been accepted.
Mm-hmm.
A year and a half transpired. On the day that we spoke last time, June 20th, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but on that day that we spoke, the EPA issued a letter, which I posted on July 5th of this year.
Uh-huh.
And in that letter, after a year and a half of no acknowledgement, no action whatsoever on a request to have that material identified, the EPA sent a letter basically disavowing any interest, any obligations, and any responsibility to identify that sample. Their keystone sentence in that letter is the following. It says, and I don't think that we covered this, and that's why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
The statement is, we would like to take this opportunity to inform you that it is not the policy of this office of EPA to test or otherwise analyze any unsolicited samples of material or matter.
Oh,
Very interesting statement, if you look at that.
Unbelievable.
First of all, policy. Really, I have no interest in policy. I have interest in obligation and law.
Unbelievable.
In terms of their duties to the public.
Seems to me they are a public servant. Aren't they, Clifford? Isn't that sort of what they're all about?
That was my understanding, and
yes.
I worked for the federal government for 15 years, and that was certainly my understanding when I worked there.
Yep.
The other interesting word in that sentence to me is the use of the word unsolicited, meaning that this is saying that unless they ask for it, they have no obligation to identify unknown material that is of concern to citizens for their health and their environment.
I wonder if that pertains to anthrax.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I wanted to, in the sense of continuity, make this action known to the public, and also to reemphasize the fact that a year and one half elapsed before they responded to this. And by the way, if you look into that response, it apparently was due to a Freedom of Information Act filed by a third party where they apparently decided they didn't want their hands on this material anymore.
Critically important to underscore the fact that this note from the EPA is not negligence. It is not incompetence. This is part of the cover-up. Another example in what you just heard Clifford read of how the government is no longer serving us, we are serving it. At least that's how the bureaucracy seems to look at it.
And that correspondence is all available on the site for people to read for themselves in the certified mail.
And they can print it out, pass it around, and whatever.
The whole story is there. With that taken care of, the next topic that emerged, and this was in July, the end of July. It's funny how it takes so long sometimes to do what seems to be obvious in retrospect, but in terms of the sampling, it's very difficult for lay people to get their hands on aerosol material. It apparently is down to submicron to micron range. It's very, very small. And air filters have been used. There's been some work with HEPA filters, but for whatever reason, I took up the idea of collecting rainwater and distilling this rainwater, basically concentrating rainwater samples. And that was done for several months, or let's say 2 months in the middle of that summer. In June, we were getting a lot of rain. And I presented a page on this, and I guess the simplest thing I can say is that people should look at these photographs. The page here would be called Rainwater Metals, would be the start of it.
Okay.
You had roughly, you could imagine, say, in the end, I'd use a quart or about a liter and took it down to just a few milliliters. But they started out being about 40 milliliters down to about 3 milliliters, so about a 10-to-1 concentration. And it absolutely astounded me when I started to see what was residual within this rainwater.
May I ask how you reduced it, just for our listeners, so they understand how you'd bring that down to 40 down to 2?
Sure, I did it by distillation. I simply hooked up a very simple distillation setup in a flask, heated that water, and drew the water out the top where it cools down. The process of distillation in its simplest form is what I used, and drew off that water through, you know, it was heated underneath with a an oil lamp, an alcohol lamp, and water eventually will, evaporate through that.
And you just grab that moisture and condensed it back down, and all right, we're going to find out what was in that water. That this is called rainwater, friends. Remember when you were a kid and we all used to go outside and open our mouths and let the raindrops go in? Or maybe we do that with snow. You might not want to do that quite so readily anymore when you hear what Clifford has found in rainwater falling all over these United States. Be right back in just a minute with Clifford Carnicom. Okay, right back with Clifford Chronicom, who's explaining how he reduced rainwater down to a workable quantity through distillation. Real simple. Okay, we've got that, Clifford. Go right ahead.
Jeff, that the purpose here was not to collect the water. It was to collect the solid materials that exist within the water.
Sure.
So the simple counterpart is simply to boil the water off. The reason that I was distilling it is I didn't want it to be contaminated in any way, so I just kept it all sealed.
Got it.
In essence, it's quite simple, quite evident, and quite plain. There is a tremendous amount of metallic material that shows up in this rainwater. You don't need a PhD to tell you what is found here is metal. The photographs are there, and actually, you know, what's going on is you're just seeing things over and over from different angles, but this is such a simple technique, which it was very sad to me when I saw this, because the amount that is in there is really amazing to me. If you check the pH of this material, it's extremely alkaline. This fits with the rainfall samples that were done, you know, months prior to that involved the whole nation taking tests. It's simply there. And, you know, there is two photographs on there, very clear for people to see. I prepared a video of it so that people could have the benefit of motion if they wanted. It takes a little while to download that because I wanted the quality of the imagery high enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just evident and clear as can be. I have air filter samples that were done over the last year and a half. They say the same thing. You have three or four things saying it over and over and over. Here you can just plain see it. I had taken straight rainwater several months ago also, and, you know, after it settled, mm-hmm. had allowed that to crystallize. I had the same thing occur in terms of the presence of magnesium, apparently to my best identification, showing up. So this is simply a simple method. This was also repeated by another individual. It's amazing how few professionals seem to make themselves available for the work that needs to be done in the testing.
Yeah, you know, you're right. We've got tens of thousands of people at the university level and outside of that who could step in here and verify, quantify, and help you assay all these materials in their own geographical locations with no trouble at all, and yet so few do.
It's absolutely amazing. And it's not even so few. It's none, apparently. Unfortunately, there are no formal tests that anyone will step up to the plate publicly and perform.
Even some of the skeptics you'd think would step in and say, I'm going to prove this guy wrong.
It's all open. It's all open. It's a matter, you know, there's a lot of talk that goes around, but it's all open and nobody conducts a test.
Amazing.
Whether it's the federal government, whether it's professional citizens, whether it's universities, nobody will conduct the test.
That's that great malaise.
Why?
That's that great malaise that they're counting on, that somnambulant state of American culture.
I mean, the obfuscation and distraction that takes place is incredible when it's very simple. The material is just there. You had another citizen on the East Coast by the name of Looking Up. It's actually done some pretty amazing work also.
Yeah.
That individual, that's a pseudonym for her on the message board. That individual performed the same test in her area and got identically the same results and was equally astounded and amazed as to what she found on the other side of the country. So continuously, over a long interval of time, you have the same data showing up over and over and over, and that is the presence of metallic particulate matter in the atmosphere in extraordinary amounts. And it's up to you whether you want to take a look at it, but the fact is it's there and you can see it, and do it yourself if you have doubts or the need to test things further, which we all do.
Mm-hmm.
This is rather an important junction point because, you know, there's a certain time when it registers in the mind. You're not dealing with, you know, an air filter where it's really hard to see this material. It's just plain there. So over the next month or two, I was taken in a different direction, and it became much more of an analytical approach. And it was the problem of saying, all right, we know the material is there. We've got to try to get a handle on how much is there.
Before we do that, Clifford, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what it was that you found in that sample?
Yes, actually, there's a whole discussion there. There's a whole set of succeeding
I know. I don't want to leave them behind.
Exactly. What I did, again, from a lay point of view, under the microscope, I did the best work that I was able to do. I performed a series of chemical tests to try and identify this material to the best of my ability. Like I say, invite all others to perform their own tests. The results of my work through fairly common and simple reagents that are available in, you know, my studying chemistry books and such, My best analysis, though, thus far, is that it appears magnesium. I actually end up with a magnesium oxide. If you remember that this material was heated in a test tube.
Okay.
So it's not a surprise at all that if you have a metal, that an oxidized form is going to take place. My best analysis of the dominant material appears to be a magnesium oxide. Like I say, the professionals can come in and do their work, but that's what I end up with. I also end up with a pretty strong case for the existence of aluminum. You have to look at the photographs and make your own judgment, but these materials have unique shapes. And aluminum is interesting. In the books that I have on aerosols, mechanics of aerosols, show it as a spherical particulate shape, which is a little bit unusual. Most of them are not. Most things are, cubic or hexagonal or whatever. But the spherical shape is listed as a photograph for aluminum. And I'll tell you, there's a set in there that shows these things. Sulfuric acid appears to make it the most visible. Almost transparent, but if you look at those photographs under the microscope, you'll see these spherical shapes. They measure about 2 microns in size, which is incredibly small. They are very difficult to see, but when you find them, that's the wrong way to say it. There's a lot of them there, but visibility is very difficult. Sulfuric acid seems to enhance that and isolate it, there's a great deal of it in there. All I can say is my work indicates the strongest candidates for further examination identification would be magnesium compounds and aluminum compounds.
And we're talking, again, aluminum down to viral size.
Yeah, incredibly small. It's very difficult with my equipment to try and get that magnification, but I did. I got it up to 2,000 times through some methods I use.
Well, amazing work. Okay, and it's all online for you if you have a interest in this and you'd like to take to some professional or lay people and say, here it is, what do you think of it? We would encourage you to do that. It's all at carnicom.com. That's CARNICOM, carnicom.com. Be right back. Got a nice email from George. I won't identify him by last name, but thank you, George. Let me read this, Clifford. Hi, Jeff. I was surprised to see the Rainwater Metals video on Mr. Carnicom's page. I did the same thing here in Alberta, Canada last summer after 3 days of heavy chemtrail activity. Here in Alberta, it rains like clockwork every morning, and rather, I should say, evening during the summer. I evaporated mine off using a vacuum pump down to 1/2 atmosphere to prevent the heat from making any chemical changes. I had the sample analyzed by a colleague at the university where I teach. The results were astounding. From aluminum oxides, barium oxides, and hydrates, titanium carbonates, alum, to long-chain polymers, it was considered by my colleague to be quite toxic in the concentrations I had distilled it down to. It would be 10,000 to 1, 1 liter down to 0.5 milliliters. I have HEPA filters in all my rooms now. I'm going to follow this research up next summer with lake and river samples. I suspect I will find similar, if slightly less concentrated, forms. Thank Mr. Carnicom for his work. We need more people like him, and so on and so forth, to wake people up. Signed, George. Thank you very much, George, for that, and I'll send this to you, Clifford, for your files.
Full statement, actually. I appreciate that one very much, because that's part of the game, is to corroborate things from different sources. I can simply say, in summary, over several years now, from numerous methods and sources, from the lay level, what it appears our primary candidates for examination would be at least 4 metals, barium, magnesium, aluminum, and calcium. In addition to what this individual has stated, certainly the polymer fibers is another whole separate topic. worthy of discussion. But
now, this can't be just jet exhaust accumulating at the higher levels.
No, the fact is it's there, and I don't know at what point. You know, at some point we have to get plain and simple, but the fact is the material's there. It's been injected into the air into large quantities.
Got it.
And it's having its effect. And, you know, people can play their games for years, but at some point we're going to get past that also and get behind the driving agenda of this program. But each of us does have to go through that process of education ourselves. I'm simply saying, in my case, it's time for, more detailed working for the nation to decide what it's going to do about this.
Well, with the nation, meaning you and I and all the wonderful people listening in. Let me read that one paragraph again from this email just to underscore what George has found. He said, I had the sample analyzed by a colleague at the university where I teach. The results were astounding. From aluminum oxides, barium oxides and hydrates, titanium carbonates, alum, to long-chain polymers, it was considered by my colleague to be quite toxic in the concentrations I had distilled it down to. I have HEPA filters in all my rooms now. So there it is. You don't want to be drinking rainwater, folks. It's not what it used to be, as they say.
You know, and unfortunately, you now have to extend your considerations to the environment and what are the effects of the environment to the environment. If it's toxic to drink, no. It's not necessarily so hot for our world as well.
Exactly. We've got to stop thinking in little compartments. It's all one piece, folks. And if it's in the rain, it's in the rivers, it's in the lakes, it's on the land, it's in the plants, it's in our food, it's everywhere.
So thanks for bringing that up, as well as examination of the specific materials. It's interesting, actually, where that led. That was a very important part to actually talk about the identification I've been able to make and in the subsequent corroboration from other sources and other locations. The next topic turned to a very analytical work, basically all pretty much theoretical, based on observation, empiricism, and deduction and analysis. And it was the question of the fact that all right, since we know the material is in the air now, no need to play that game forever, how much is there? So the desire was to try and come up with some kind of quantitative estimate as to how much is there. And that ends up, you know, being a very difficult problem because we don't have anybody that's out there measuring. It's very simple if you have the right support and equipment and people behind
it. Sure.
You know, to get some particulate counts and this type of thing, but I don't have it. Mostly what I have is my mind. And I have to try and solve the problems as best I'm able to. And this one was another session of pretty serious and extended thought. In the end, the problem centered around visibility. It's pretty interesting, but, you know, in the end, things are really quite simple. It's a matter of getting to them in the right way. But there is a direct relationship between visibility in the air and what is called the extinction coefficient. And whenever I speak terms in math, and I'll always try to explain it from a couple ways, but I do want to get the terms out and numbers out so that people know the legitimate research does need to be done. But there is a quantity called an extinction coefficient, and basically it stems from the idea of the attenuation of light. If you send a beam of light through particles, that beam of light will be attenuated. It will be attenuated in an exponential form. And the magnitude by which it attenuates or decreases is expressed through a quantity called the extinction coefficient. And I started to look into this thing and basically learn about it and see how it can relate towards trying to come up with an estimate of the amount of materials in the sky. And one of the first things that became interesting to me was it was difficult, and it always generally has been difficult for me to get a hold of some databases that I think should be available. There is this device called a nephelometer. I've never seen one. I can only read about it thus far. And it is a device which measures this extinction coefficient. And so I start looking around, you know, researching for databases. And I find all kinds of information telling, you know, what it is that such things are being measured by numerous people. Numerous government and agencies are measuring these particles all the time. But then when I try to find databases, I find them very difficult to find. I can't get the raw data. And by data, I mean current, real-time data on measurements that are being taken by official sources. After quite a bit of looking, I'm coming up pretty much empty with respect to real hardcore raw data. I found one source, it's the University of Maryland, that had their data up on the net. And started to take a look at the actual numbers that were there.
Uh-huh.
And these numbers were concurring with the visibility situation and the deterioration of visibility that we find ourselves in. There's a whole separate topic that you and I have already discussed, I think, regarding the change in the visibility standards from 40 miles to 10 miles.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that in a clear environment, desert environment, you can easily see 90 to 120 miles, and we have visibility commonly being reported at 10 miles. In fact, a maximum being set at 10 miles. It's absolutely ludicrous and absurd for people to say that the visibility conditions of our atmosphere have not changed dramatically over the last 3 years in direct correlation to these aerosol operations.
Exactly.
It's quite evident, again, as the rainwater metallic particulates are, it's a matter of at what point you wish to accept it. We have mountains here that, a big set in Albuquerque about 50 miles away and another set 20 miles away. You know, you ought to be able to see these in double, and we have many, many cases where you literally can barely see these mountains 20 miles away now.
Friends, this is not smog. We're not talking smog here, just to get that straight.
Not at all. The stuff is just there. I mean, it's that simple. And so my question is, how much is there? And so this one data source that I found, sure enough, was corresponding exactly with the estimates of visibility that were expected in relation to this measured quantity called the extinction coefficient. It was also out of hand. It was not what you would expect it to be. The visibility is much lower than it's expected to be. Also, the sources I have will say visibility is expected to increase during the summer months, and here it was, visibility was decreasing during the summer months. So this was one of the first times where I had a relationship between a known relationship between visibility and a quantity which can be measured, and fortunately which I was able to find at least one contemporary source for at a university. The next step now, and the extinction coefficient by itself doesn't do much for us, but as with a lot of my work, they're sort of composed of a series of stepping stones where one thing will lead to another with enough thought and deliberation. And the next part of this chain is a very important one, and that is when you have this extinction coefficient, which, remember, is directly related to visibility, you can consider those two things hand in hand. Once you have that, there is, within what is called the theory of light scattering, there is a whole theory of science called light scattering, and it studies how light is attenuated, what happens to light when it goes through particulate matter, exactly in the type of setup that we're talking about. It's a very involved, important branch of science, actually. And if you start studying that science, you will see that there are relationships that have been established. Remember, these are all models. Much of science is based on models. There are relationships between this extinction coefficient and or visibility, and this is what's important, the number of particles in the air and their size. And that is a very important link to make.
Okay, the number of particles in the air,
the number
and
of particles
their size
in a volume, a given volume of air,
okay,
and the size of the particles that are there.
Okay.
And that is a very crucial link to make, because here's what you're saying. You're saying, I can only see so long. If I can only see such and such a distance, then in theory, I should be able to determine, make an estimate, based on estimate, on the amount of material that's there and how big it is in the sky.
Got it. What's blocking my view? Okay. We're going to pause and take a listen to what they commonly call news for a couple of minutes. We'll be right back with Clifford Carnicom to follow this latest update on the chemtrail controversy as it affects each and every one of us listening in and participating tonight. We'll pause and take a few minutes off while we're away. If you're online, do go to rents.com. Take a look at the raft of new material up. There's some very, very interesting stories especially today as the web gets thicker. We'll see you in a few minutes.